Thank you for downloading the IA podcast. The episode you're about to listen to was originally featured as a video on the IA's YouTube channel, IA London. But we've taken the audio and we've turned it into a podcast so you can listen on the go. Enjoy.
Good evening and welcome to the IA Book Club. Now, before we get on to the book and, of course, the author, I just have to address some very quick housekeeping points. Just to let you know that this event is being live streamed onto the IA YouTube channel. It will also be there for you to watch afterwards and catch up if you'd like. We'll begin proceedings tonight with a discussion between me and George for about 20 or 25 minutes, and we will then have plenty of time for you all here with us in the room to ask some questions. Unfortunately, in the interests of simplicity, because I can't deal with both Roman history and modern technology, speaking of which, culprit in the audience here with the modern technology. I can't deal with Roman history and modern technology at the same time, so we'll only be taking questions from people in the room. Obviously, please do all turn your mobile phones onto silent. And with that out of the way, I'm delighted to introduce tonight's author, the academic and writer, Dr. George Marr. And we are going to discuss his latest book. George holds a PhD in the economy of the Roman Empire from King's College London. He's a fellow of the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries. He was a director and trustee of the Society for the Promotion of Roman Studies and a partner at Tilling Gas Towers Perrin, where he also continues to practice in consultancy. Most recently, of course, he's written this fascinating book, Pugnare, Economic Success and Failure. George, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thank you very much.
So I really enjoyed the book. I think it's such an interesting and underappreciated angle on classical history. Mm. And so I wonder if we could start with an overview from you of some of the principles that underpinned Roman economic policy. I'd say there's a lot in there from reading the book that people here at the IEA would be nodding along in agreement with: private property, competition, specialization. But in many ways, it sounds like it was also quite a top-down command economy in some senses, with stimulus packages fueled by pillaging the neighbouring territories that perhaps liberal economists today wouldn't favour so much. So what was the secret of their economic success for such a long time?
I read a book once about the money market, and it was written by an English author who is normally known for what he writes about the English constitution. And there was a bit that stood out in it for me, and it was his description of how the city of London worked in the 19th century. And it was a place which attracted people whose only assets were time, brains, and the desire to maximize the value of both. And the city of London was founded by the Romans, and that attitude and the opportunity for people like that to maximize value for them is what you see happening throughout the Roman Empire. It's they were renowned for pillaging, and some of their pillaging was pretty awful. I mean, Caesar wandering through Gaul and enslaving a million people. I mean, that is pretty ghastly. But as they moved from a conquest model to a trade model, some of the stuff they had in the past, so private property, you know, you make money, you get to keep most of it. And things like that were the foundation of their economic success. I mean, a wonderful banking system enabling people to trade across great expanses without, you know, bringing along sack loads of coins. Things like that. They're very similar to England, to Great Britain at the beginning of the 19th century.
And now you mentioned there about the enslavement of the Gauls.
Sure.
And I guess modern economists these days would argue that slavery is not particularly economically efficient, in addition, of course, to being morally wrong. How important was the trade and use of slaves to the Roman economic model? There's some fascinating details in the book about how landowners would calculate to a very precise amount exactly how much food a slave needed to produce the exact amount of labour so that they wouldn't overfeed them. Sure. But then there's also some very positive stories in there about slaves who were freed and managed to really make a fortune and a name for themselves. Sure.
There were different forms of slavery. So if you were a slave captured somewhere, you know, taken away from your family, never to see your parents again, all the rest, and sent down a silver mine. I mean, that is a ghastly existence. Worked worse than a brute animal. But a lot of the slaves were working as household slaves, where they became almost parts of the family, and you know, regularly they were freed. And they had the rights of a Roman citizen, and their children were Roman citizens. And you know, something well over 50% of such slaves were routinely freed, almost as a reward for their services, an encouragement for loyalty, and an encouragement for them to use their talents to the best of their abilities, for the benefit of their master. But you see them all over the place. Memorials as you go into the city of Rome, celebrate the successful life of someone who was freed.
So there was very much a culture of meritocracy in play, and I think that also goes for the way government worked, the sort of public-private partnership, I suppose. Sure. we would call it, to be a little bit ahistoric there. And I guess the whole style of government is not really what we would recognise today as being a democracy, or certainly not a liberal democracy. But there was this, I guess we could call it a meritocratic technocracy combined with a sort of constitutional monarchy, could we say. And I wonder, is that something, is there anything we could learn here where we have people like Dominic Cummings and Kate Bingham calling for civil service reform to move away from groupthink and risk aversion? And really improve decision-making and the quality within the civil service. Do you think we could learn anything from the way the Romans used to run
infrastructure projects? I think we can learn tons from them, because I think their fundamental talent was they knew how people should organise themselves to achieve the best outcome for the individual and for the group. I mean, they did it spectacularly in their conquest. And there was a Roman writer of the 2nd century BC, his name was Polybius, and he was captured by the Romans, taken to Rome. And he looked at this marvellous world he'd come to, this marvellous world that had conquered Greece. And he said, what is it about them that makes them better than us? Because, you know, they've conquered us. And he ended up saying that it was their constitution and the way they balanced the interests of the electorate, the people, the parliament, the senate, and then the leaders that in those days they elected for a term of 1 year, the consuls. How do we get these three pieces to work together? And it was by having a checks and balances, balances between the three constituents. Something which George Washington and his friends copied when they wrote the American Constitution. So I think their talent was in how they organized themselves. And, you know, we can look at ways in which things are organized nowadays. I mean, and ask, do they get the best out of people? And if they don't, maybe they should change. And maybe there are models there.
I guess a lot of it was down to incentives. There were genuine incentives to be able to progress through your career by having demonstrated successful maintenance of the waterways.
Yes,
for example.
Yes. Incentives and fundamentally understanding human nature and how people work, and not doing it in some idealistic way of thinking, well, this is how they should work. But no, this is how people actually work. This is what matters to people, and this is what they do to look after themselves and those who matter to them.
So I guess another central plank of Roman economic success, you alluded to it briefly before, was the monetary policy.
Sure.
And some quite extraordinary developments over, the centuries that you cover in the book. It's a key factor, clearly, in certainty and stability allowing trade. But then, towards the end, it became a key factor in the instability and the decline. So what was it that those early emperors like Vespasian got right that the later generations in the period of decline started to get wrong?
What you are alluding to there is like a key to their success. I mean, they were highly urbanized with trade across great expanses and without a good monetary system and good banking system, they couldn't have done what they did do. It's a tricky thing because to keep something like this going, you need to understand how the system works. And if you as a collective understand how the system works, you can keep it going. And a way maybe to illustrate it is what's happening at the moment. We have what's called quantitative easing. And people say, it's quantitative easing, it's not printing money. It's printing money. And if we don't understand that it's printing money, then we will have the consequences of what happens when you print money. And so we have inflation starting to increase, and we have people producing models saying, oh, it's okay, it'll go up a bit, it's just temporary, it'll come down. So we are at risk of moving into exactly the space that the Romans moved into at the end of the second century, which is we are at risk of moving into the area where we no longer understand, as well as our predecessors did, how our system works. And if we're some distance away from the cliff edge, but if we don't keep that understanding, then we will suffer what they suffered. The direct answer to your question is, Vespasian understood how the money system worked, and so did the senators in the Senate in his time, so did Augustus, so did Trajan, but the people who came after Trajan, particularly Commodus, and the senators at the time who should have said no, didn't.
And I guess they're a large part of the success in those successful periods was the reforms that Vespasian, I think it was Vespasian, who brought in the centralization of the mint. I wonder there, that clearly that centralization and the single currency worked very well for the Roman Empire for a long time. I wonder why do you think it hasn't worked so well for the euro, or perhaps you think it is working quite well for the euro. It just needs to be given time. What do you think? Are there parallels there for how the eurozone is working?
The nice thing about monetary control in the United Kingdom and the United States is it's very accountable. So you have the governor of the Bank of England and the deputy governors, and every few months they're in front of the House of Commons Select Committee and the House of Lords Select Committee, and they get grilled. That's called accountability. And that stops things going wrong. You have similar accountability in the US. Whether you have the same in the euro area, I don't know. I haven't seen the equivalent of a select committee. And if they're not being accountable, they will make mistakes.
And what about the fiscal aspects that run alongside sort of the monetary aspects? That, I suppose, must go hand in hand with accountability. Mm-hmm. Was taxation also very centralized in the Roman Empire? And I suppose, you know, what did they spend their money on? We know they spent a lot of money on infrastructure, and in certain eras they spent a lot of money on palaces and entertainments. But how did public spending look?
Public spending for the Romans looked exactly like it did for Great Britain when Victoria came to the throne. almost all of the public expenditure was for the army, as it was in the time of Queen Victoria. And so long as you kept the cost of the army under control, you were okay. And they kept that cost pretty constant for about 200 years. So they're managing the state expenditure. When they let it start to creep up, as they did in the time of Commodus. Then things started to go wrong, which is kind of the same as for now.
Well, actually, I've got a quote here about those inflationary tendencies caused by politically motivated pay rises for the army. Mm-hmm. You said there were vast sums of money were given to men who were already being paid and did no extra work for this additional reward, did not increase their economic activity or generate additional goods or services or build anything for the future. Which I think certainly seems to have some parallels for present-day Britain, but perhaps substituting the NHS for the army.
If you take the largest item of current expenditure and you treble it, you will have to pay that this year, next year, the year after, and all the rest, and you bankrupt the state. And if you want to know how to destroy a state, I mean, read the chapter called Chaos. I mean, and it'll work now.
Yeah, you're not making me feel any better about this.
And that is to actually miss, the real, real achievements of those people. Because the crisis that they did not survive was not the only crisis that they had. They had a far, far more severe crisis in the first century BC. And they survived that beautifully. They took a system which was no longer working. They adjusted it because they collectively wanted to survive. They were in a world which had become very very unequal. Some people had loads of money and other people didn't. And they leveled up. They shared the spoils. They readjusted a system which, you know, was unstable. And that lasted beautifully. There was a crisis after Nero, a very big crisis. They solved it within a year. And they kept going for over 200 years. Mm-hmm. So the story isn't so much the crisis that killed them as the crises before that they survived.
Yeah.
And maybe if they hadn't had things so easy for so long, they wouldn't have been as complacent as they probably were. And they might have fought and adapted in the way they had done in the time of Augustus and of Nero. Mm. And perhaps that might make you feel better.
I'm not sure it does. I think that also sounds like present day Western civilization.
The beautiful thing that Augustus did was not just economic. It was not just taking the treasures of Egypt, making them into coins rather than gilded palaces, letting that go out. There's work to be done, there's employment, there are new skills. The beautiful, beautiful thing that he did, and the people around him, was they started a literary revival which was stupendous. So you have some of the greatest poetry that was ever written, that still lives, that inspired Shakespeare, and which spoke of important values. Mm. It spoke of, you know, we are here. There are people who are before us who are great people. You know, there will be great things in front of us. We are an inclusive people. We bring people in. We have survived worse than this. Someday we will sing of our survival. And it was that which made the difference. And if we can't sing like that nowadays, then we will rightly feel miserable. If we can't see the beauty in the world and, you know, what can be done.
And see a future.
And absolutely see a future. I mean, it's a God-given privilege to be alive. And it's a God-given privilege to be alive in a country such as this, you know, that people swim across or go across a channel where they might die to get to. And if we, you know.
Well,
And Augustus would have had poets write about the beauty of our world.
Speaking of Britain in particular, and people crossing the channel, albeit in a perhaps slightly different way, you've got quite a few reflections in the book about Roman Britain. How typical was Roman Britain of that imperial operating model?
You say imperial. Tacitus wrote a book called Agricola, and it talks about, you know, what some people might call the conquest of Britain or whatever it might have been. And what they very, very, very quickly learnt was if you want to take an imperial approach and, you know, have a standing army and you're going to settle this place by any time there's a bit of trouble, you're just going out terrorizing people. It doesn't work, because what they naturally do, and these people understood human nature, is you just basically encourage people to fight against you. So what they did was they said, let us act in such a way that people want to emulate us. People want to be like us. People want to do the things that we can do. Now, not everyone will want to. I mean, some people will want to live the wonderful ancient tribal life. And that was how they managed affairs.
And obviously we have some amazing, legacies from those Roman times.
Sure.
Obviously, Hadrian's Wall as a proud Northumbrian.
Sure.
I'll mention that. You talk about the Mithraeum.
The Mithraeum in London is amazing.
In the city of London. And then that amazing discovery just last week.
Sure.
of the mosaic.
Sure.
Can you just tell us a bit about how things like, I guess, that mosaic, which must have been a pretty amazing thing in its time.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I guess that connects with that flourishing of art and literature that you mm-hmm. were talking about. So clearly the Romans have come to Britain. It's a bit of a edge of the world, windswept, probably quite depressing for someone who's used to the glories of Rome. And yet they laid down roots and produced works like that.
I think it was just, there's a wonderful flow of information. So you go to Rome and you see in the port of Ostia, the place where the merchants all sat together, there's a wonderful flow of information going on all over the place. And people are hearing of, stuff that you see in Rome. They've got these beautiful mosaics, or in little insignificant towns like Pompeii. And it's just going around, and then sort of someone who's got spare cash says, I want something like that. So he finds it out from someone. It's a flow of information and things that can be copied, and there's profit in all of this,
because competition
and the profit for the individual.
And so actually,
and I think it was probably very exciting actually to come to windswept London and see the place being transformed. It's a new vibrant city.
And so do you think track London's roots as a trading centre all the way back to Roman times?
Absolutely.
There's a thread.
Absolutely. It is absolutely extraordinary. The extent to which those traces have remained mm-hmm. and have shaped things, because life is incremental. If you look at just the map of the British Isles, you have the Celtic cultures in Scotland and in Ireland and part of Wales, and those cultures remain distinctly different well into the 17th century and beyond. And those are the parts of the British Isles that the Romans didn't touch. And you can imagine someone in, say, some Roman town like maybe Rochester or something like that, and there's a bridge across the river, and it may be falling down and dilapidated. And you can imagine someone in the Celtic tribes in the west of Ireland by the Shannon, and people growing up in those two places, well after the Romans have gone, a young boy or a young girl, they're seeing something very, very different. The young boy in Rochester, the young girl in Rochester is seeing people can build bridges. Mm. We can't, actually, because it's lost, but people can build bridges across wild rivers. So you're more likely to get a bridge. And that's kind of like an incremental thing, and it's fundamentally has shaped. You can actually wander around the city of London and you can see the shape of the Roman town.
I must admit, I used to work.
I can give you an example.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
You go to the corner of Gracechurch Street and Lime Street and you walk down to the Lloyd's building. You are walking right through the Roman Forum. If you go a bit around Lime Street and you walk down Fenchurch Street, you're walking on the edge of the Roman Forum. The street patterns are mm-hmm. have remained. Mm-hmm. Lloyd's is a market. It's beside Leadenhall Market. That was a market. People there are moving around, meeting each other for coffee, for a pint, for lunch. They're sharing information, they're chatting, they're gossiping. And in some of those interactions, a deal happens. That is no different to when the city was established. The continuity of life is extraordinary.
Yes. I must admit to my shame, I used to work on Cannon Street, right next to Mithraeum, and I never went to visit, so I have...
No. You shouldn't. It's inspiring. It's wonderful. You really should. And I'll tell you, you'll see some amazing things there. They've done a beautiful job on it. And you'll even see something which is the equivalent of a banknote, which predates Chinese paper money by centuries.
Yeah, that is amazing.
And it's not labelled as such, because they don't know it's that, but that's what it is.
Right.
If we go there, you know, just the two of us, I'll show it to you. And if there are 40 people in the room, there'll be only two people who know that's a banknote.
Amazing.
It is utterly amazing. Utterly amazing. It was, in its time, it's a piece of wood, like a banknote is a piece of paper or plastic, and in its time it had a face value of £3,000 in our terms. And you move around, and that will help you with your trading operation.
And so how common was that, as opposed to the coinage?
It's very common.
Oh,
you,
right.
And the legal form, I mean, on a banknote it says, I promise to pay the bearer on demand.
Yeah.
And that language originally created the instrument. And the formula is different, but it is a formula, and that formula is a very standard formula.
And that would be backed by a commercial bank
Commerce in the 19th century and the 18th century, the credit of the issuing individual.
Right. Okay, so more, I guess, similar to a letter of credit.
Similar to letter of credit trading. Or a bill of exchange, yeah. or a promissory note or a banknote.
Yeah, so that's obviously essential for trading in any meaningful scale.
Absolutely, which is what they had.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Seneca, for example, lent out, in our terms, over £200 million to the natives of London and the surrounding area. And, you know, you don't do that by shipping over, you know, wheelbarrows full of coins. You do it through correspondence, through notes, through bills of exchange.
Yes, and of course they had limited liability corporations
absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. The biggest mistake that we can ever make is to think we're better than the people who came before us. Because we ain't.
Well, on that note, I'll open it up to our friends in the audience. I can see some hands going up already. We've got Thomas has the roving mic, so if you could please use the roving mic so the people watching on YouTube will be able to hear. And if you could please say your name before you ask your question. Gentleman over here on this side, please.
So I'm Jonathan Campbell-James. Did the Romans have a concept of fraud, and did they have a system for dealing with fraud?
They very much had a concept of fraud. Indeed, the word is a Roman word. I mean, I think the Latin is fraus, fraudis, and dealing with it like all things like that. They have a legal system. So you go to the magistrate, you ask for him to appoint an arbiter, and he will adjudicate. I mean, I presume there's going to be a dispute. You're saying I've defrauded you, in this contract. And it will be adjudicated, and it will be adjudicated in public, just like in the Royal Courts of Justice. So there will be people watching. So it's my reputation as well as anything else, and a bit of fun for the onlookers.
Gosh, Felix.
Thank you. My name is Felix. You talked briefly about the crisis that killed them.
Yes.
Maybe speak a little bit more about that. What was the crisis that killed them, and to what extent can we pin the downfall and breakup of the Roman Empire, at least in the West, on their economic policy?
Okay, so the crisis, it's like when anything goes wrong. There are trigger events, but there is always something that went wrong before. if I were to take one thing, it is they had maintained superb discipline in, as far as the pay of the army was concerned. So that's their biggest item of expenditure. And then in the reign of Commodus, the second half of the second century, they allowed the cost of the army to start creeping up. For close on 200 years, it hadn't moved. And that introduced sort of a lack of discipline. The expectations of the soldiers were completely different. And the cost just started to spiral. They paid for the army out of tax. They no longer have enough tax, so they have to do what we call quantitative easing. They have to debase the coinage. So they'll take, 200 silver coins, melt them down, add in some cheap metal, and produce 220 coins. But as you do that, the currency becomes valueless. It got to the stage where the rate at which a silver coin would change for a gold coin, which had been constant for 200 years, broke down. And around about that time, you see the banking system collapse. You see dictators emerge who basically buy the support of the army, which hadn't happened before. When the currency is gone, when the banking system is gone, then the urban life can no longer be sustained. Trade can no longer happen. Before 250 AD, you scarcely see any coins on shipwrecks. So if the shipwreck dates to before 250 AD, you're not going to find any coins. After 250 AD, it's industrial quantities of coins because the banking system has collapsed. Those notes that we were just talking about, they will only work if there's trust and law being, impartially enforced. So that is the crisis that happened.
So was the crisis brought about by the economic policy, or were the economic policies, for example, propping up the army for support, was that brought about? Do you see what I mean? Which came first?
Well,
the political crisis or the economic crisis?
You have something going wrong within how the people feel about themselves and who they respect. Before all of this happens, you can see that the institutions that sustain this thing are being mocked, and those who mock are being allowed to get away with it. Then you see things loosening. Then they make decisions that predecessors wouldn't have made. Then you have complete and utter political chaos. So self-belief is going wrong. Wrong economic and other things happen. Mm-hmm. Bad politics after that, and very bad politics.
So there was a sort of culture war. There was a sort of culture war going on.
There's always got to be a war within any robust society, but it's when the values go wrong. Mm-hmm. It's when the values go wrong.
Yes, someone here on this side.
Thank you, first of all, Dr. Mayor, for your excellent talk so far. My name's William. So just a couple of short questions. First of all, did the Romans themselves have a concept of economics and economic policy? And if not, how is it possible, or at least what challenges do you face trying to write an economic history of a society that doesn't have itself a concept of economics?
Sure.
Or economic policy? And secondly, by focusing primarily on economics, the exclusion of, say, politics or social or cultural or artistic changes, etc., how does our understanding of the narrative of Roman history change? And especially, if possible, if you can make any sort of reference to Henri Pirenne and his favourite thesis, because I've always found that quite fascinating. That would be especially appreciated.
Okay, I'll answer your first question, and before I answer your second question, you'll tell me what his thesis is. The Romans didn't have a concept of the cardiovascular system, but each of them, had a heart and lungs, and they understood exercise. and they understood how people can train themselves well and so on. So to what extent do they have a, and you'll excuse me saying so, sophisticated understanding of economics like we sophisticated people have, is a good question. I think I'm an actuary by training, so when I see models, I think, you know, so what? In many cases, I think they understood very, very much, you know, at their peak, how the world works and how you can delude yourself. And I think they were a pragmatic people who understood motivation and common sense. And it's that sort of stuff which helps. You know, which helps you run things well. So when Vespasian centralizes the currency, I mean, that is a hugely beneficial to them. Now, the poor man didn't have a degree in economics, you know, so I mean, he was lucky.
So how did he know that was a good thing to do?
Because
then?
He understands how the world works, how people work. I mean, I really, you know.
He didn't have an Office of Budget Responsibility to
No. That they understood budget responsibility, right. And that they worked out very well. The first job, if you want to be a successful politician, in the Roman Republic and afterwards, the first job is you stand for election as state accountant, and there are a few of them. So budget responsibility, right at the beginning. Your other question was, I think, I don't know the man's thesis, and you'll tell me, I'm sure. The other question was to look at it from an economic point of view, separating politics and cultural.
And how does it sort of affect or change the traditional narrative? You know, because I guess in many people's heads there's a sort of, I don't know, Gibbonian transition from, and there's some nice emperors, then there's some rubbish emperors, then there's a big civil war, and then you end up with lots of barbarians and it all goes to pot. So if you focus on economics,
do those days cease to matter as much as they would in the traditional version? And I don't know if you also looked at it through the lens of art or culture or late antiquity and all the rest. Would that also change how one sort of chooses to view Roman history?
I think it's almost as if in 2,000 years they are trying to reconstruct what's happening in this city, this country, this world by looking at, I'm going to exaggerate, the gossip and political columns of the newspapers. There is a lot more going on in the world now than you know, comments about political leaders. I mean, and if you only look at the political leaders, if all you're going to talk about is this is a good emperor, that's a bad emperor, then I think you're missing most of the play. I mean, most of the achievement, most of the excitement, most of what was. Like to be alive then, most of the wonder of their world.
Any more questions? Yes, here on this side.
Thank you. My name's George.
Snap.
In your book, you talk about, it's interesting because the empire falls when the army get out of control. In fact, the army were out of control in the time of Caesar, if I'm right.
Yes.
And how did they manage to... Was it Augustus manage to swing things back? How did he manage with carrot and stick to try and put the empire on a course that would make it so successful? And other lessons I wonder whether we could learn from what he did to try and win people over who had it in their interest to go looting and pillaging all the time.
Sure. I mean, that if I may say so, is a fascinating question, because you've got two ends of a story. You've got the time of Julius Caesar, when the thing is out of control. And what Julius Caesar one of the things that Julius Caesar did was he doubled the pay of the army, unlawfully, which creates indiscipline. I mean, you know, you just... You can't have a disciplined army if you're going to be remunerating them like that. Then you have, at the other end, the stuff that went wrong with Commodus, and then the doubling in around about AD 193 by Septimius Severus, and after that, the whole thing falls apart. And in between those two points, you have an army whose pay does not increase, with the exception of a tiny little blip under Domitian, all right? And actually, most of the money that the army, that the soldier is being paid, is taken in deductions. So two-thirds is deducted for his food, his bed, bedding, and all the rest. But there must have been some magic going on. There must have been some sense of maybe the authority of the leader, some inspiration. But some of the important things that happened were, first of all, he introduced a pension fund, or he and the people at the time introduced a pension fund, payable to you at the end of your 20 years service, or later when the extended service, 25 years.
This was Augustus.
Augustus, in the time of Augustus. Because I don't think it's just the man. I mean, I think he's very admirable, but you cannot do these things on your own. The group has to be supporting you. So that's the first thing that he's doing. So you as a soldier are being offered a prospect of a very large sum of money after 20 years service, with which you could buy a small plot of land, or you know, you could deposit it with that banker, you could go into business. You might have learned stuff when you were in service in Syria and you end up in Britain or something. The other thing that he did was he gave them a stable currency. So you have your silver coins and your gold coins, and they exchange at a fixed rate. So if you've got so many gold coins, you know exactly how many silver coins you'll get. So you'll be able to, you know, buy bread with that, you know, pay your rent or whatever. So there is, and they can go into the market, and they can use these coins. So that's also a disciplined thing. It's gone away from the concept of we rely on booty. We rely on pillaging. But there was maybe some magic that was happening, some inspiration. Maybe it was just a wonderful time to be alive.
Yes, this person over on this side, please.
Thank you. my name is Sahil. You mentioned inflation. What was their approach to curbing high rates of inflation? And related to that, did at any point the Roman Empire, did they have a central banking system, and how would that compare to what we have today?
Okay. Compare in terms of the banking, or compare in terms of the inflation?
The central banking system.
Okay, central banking. Inflation, they kept inflation at close to zero for 200 years, largely because they controlled state expenditure, and largely also because their world was an orderly, peaceful world within its borders from the time of Augustus. So they had the enforcement of the rates between the silver and gold coins. And as far as the central bank is concerned, the Bank of England is a 17th century establishment, but it didn't become a central bank until maybe halfway through the 19th century. And it became a central bank when it became the lender of last resort. And that function from time to time was played in the Roman Empire by the state. So in not always, and it's not formally an institution like the Bank of England is now, but in AD 33, when they had their great financial crisis, equivalent to ours of 2008-2009, the banking system is collapsing with all the problems that will flow from that and that were flowing from it. The state intervened, and I think it was something like £1 billion in our terms was injected into the banks as interest-free loans for 3 years. So that was the state on that occasion acting as a central bank. So to an extent, yes. And probably more so than existed at the beginning of the 19th century.
Any more questions? Yes, someone over here on this side, Thomas.
John Cassell-Smith. There seems to me a greater interest at the moment in the decline of the empire and the fall of the empire. What do you think are the achievements that survived, and do they mark our own time?
Do they mark our own time? I think that there are a load of achievements, and even that point of decline, the thing didn't die; its influence continued. But I would summarise the economic achievements as the GDP per capita in the time of Trajan was greater than the GDP per capita when Queen Victoria came to the throne. And you know that is an achievement. I think besides, you know, that wonderful time of you know, the late first century and the second century, when you had an area bigger than the European Union with a common law, with a law which was common across it. So my contract is between me and the fellow who's going to accuse me of fraud is as enforceable in the same words in London as in Rome, where someone who is born in Syria can hear of what's happening in London and move from Syria to London and take up work there. That wonderful peaceful time, you know, with burgeoning trade. Living conditions improving, fantastic opportunities for people. That is one of their great achievements. But you know, every story ends, and a story is good if it is worth repeating, and a story is good if people learn from it. And one of the achievements of the Roman Empire is one that they never saw. So when those English gentlemen in the 18th century at the other side of the Atlantic set about creating a new world, you know, they were educated in the classics and they borrowed from it. And they had the advantage also, they saw what worked, what didn't work. And we mistake, I think, a lot when we think about George Washington and his friends. We don't quite understand how they would have looked at the stories they were hearing. Because we live in such an immensely rich age where, you know, everyone has running water. No one has seen children running barefoot through the streets of a capital city as they would have seen 100 years ago. And I mentioned Queen Victoria and the wealth of London when she came to the throne. But George Washington and his friends were looking at a world which had a higher average income than their own world. And what they built drew on that. So they had a system of checks and balances, which Polybius had described. They built their state buildings in the architectural vernacular of the Romans. They called one of their bodies the Senate, and so on. So and half of the words that we're using in this room today come from that beautiful Latin language. I think those are the best achievement of those people is that they mattered, they provided examples that are worth studying, and they continue to be talked about in this strange age with all these cameras and technology, you know.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the book.
Thank you very much.
Gareth Sutcliffe. You were mentioning just now how the Romans borrowed various ideas were borrowed from the Romans. Did the Romans themselves borrow any ideas from anyone else they came into contact with or conquered?
The Romans were absolutely fantastic borrowers. And in a wonderful mixture. They believed that they were born to rule, that they were better than everyone else. But that absolutely did not stop them stealing everyone's ideas, which I think is just the best best ever. So there were two superpowers. There used to be two superpowers, the Soviet Union and the United States. There were two superpowers, the Romans and the Carthaginians. The Romans are good on land, and the Carthaginians are good at sea. So, you know, they beat the Carthaginians somewhere, they capture the ships, they go and they copy the ships. This was back in the pillage days now, which is before the wonderful trade days. They had great military success in Spain, and they saw that these Hispanics had this sword, the gladius, shorter than the one they had, and that seemed to be working better than theirs, so they pinched that. But I think they were also good at pinching ideas, but they were also extremely good, and maybe this was their talent, their organization, at making them work. So this concept of having a currency which consisted of a gold coin, a silver coin, and copper coins, and the gold and silver exchanging at fixed rates, which didn't work again until the 18th century in Britain. Alexander the Great had come up with that idea, but he couldn't get it to work for more than a year, because then people would say, the price of gold has gone up, I'm not trading it for those silver coins, you know, I need 30 now. So they pinched the idea from him, but they made it work. So, I guess when Roman children were growing up, their parents said, you know, fight for your country and plagiarize, you know.
yes, another question here.
Sorry, me again. Just another couple of quick ones. First of all, when you mentioned that great stat about GDP per capita being higher in the age of Trajan than it was in the age of Victoria, or at least when she came to the throne, what's the evidential basis for that? How can we sort of measure that? How can we understand that? How can we know that, etc.? And then, as an extension of the previous gentleman's question, how did the rise of Christianity at all change the way that Roman society was organised in an economic sense? Did it fundamentally affect the sort of values that allowed Rome to organise itself economically, I should say, instead, in the ways that allowed for its great success?
Great. So the effect of Christianity, but first on GDP, you can look at GDP by looking at urbanisation, the level of urbanisation in the society, and the extent to which the city is allowing people to do very specialised work, and also the extent to which there is significant trade, and that's one part of it. And there are lots of people who have produced estimates of GDP from the 19th century onwards. You can also get at it by looking at productivity in particular sectors such as agriculture. As far as the story of Christianity is concerned, with all modesty, I think this is one area in which Gibbon, who was an absolutely marvellous writer, got it wrong. And that actually goes back to your earlier question, because had Gibbon fully understood what was happening within the economy, he would have gotten the dates. He would have had different dates, and he would have seen the real rise of Christianity as coming after the collapse of the system. Christianity, you see in the first century as emerging, and the second century is emerging, and you see, and this again goes to your first question, because some of the first persecutions are happening under Nero. So that is when St. Paul and St. Peter are martyred. And if you allow, as well as the politics and all the stories, if you allow the economics to come into the story, you see that what is happening in the time of Nero is economic disaster. And you can see things are going wrong economically. And you can have a theory, which may be right or may not be right, but when things are going wrong, societies often look for someone to blame. And that you see is happening in the time of Nero. At least that's how I would look at that particular aspect. When you come to 260 AD and thereabouts, that is when you start to have the great persecutions. And that is when the system has really collapsed, when there is real chaos, there is real poverty. And after that, I think that what really has happened is that a world which you know, had had some good values, but had also some what we would call bad values, uncaring values, which had a lot of inequality in it, just starts to lose it. And the Christian message is a message that is going to be heard, feed my sheep, you know, blessed be the poor, and so on. So I think it's the old values had run their course and the new values are coming in. But I don't see a causal connection. I don't think that the system failed because of Christian values are the other way around. One thing that's very interesting about it is that if you compare budget spend of the government in the 19th century, the first half of the 19th century, and during the time of the Roman Empire, they're similar. So 5 or 10% more during times of war. And nowadays, it's much higher. And most of that difference reflects what, you know, what are the values of the Christian religion and other religions, you know, look after the poor, protect the sick, and educate. I mean, and the fact that so much of our income, you know, goes to those things. I mean, is one of the marvelous aspects of the time in which we live. If I've answered your questions, thank you, my friend.
Great. Well, I think if we've had all the questions, and thank you very much for your excellent questions, I think we'll draw that to a close. I'd like to say thank you to IEA Book Club members for your support that lets us bring you these fascinating discussions. And of course, thank you to all IEA donors who keep the building warm and keep the lights on and allow us to do all of this. If you're not already an IEA Book Club member, and you'd like to receive invitations to these events and get priority access to our books, get the chance to interact with IA researchers and leading free markets and classical liberal authors, please do either go to our website, or if you're here right now, you can speak to my colleague Alex, who is by the door at the back there.